Good morning. Go ahead and be seated.
Did I bring my glasses?
Yeah. Okay, our first case up this morning is docket number 68949, Boulder Cap versus District Court. Mr. Winner, are you ready? Okay, if you'd like to come up.
Thank you.
And would you like to reserve any time?
Thank you. I will reserve 3 minutes for
okay.
If necessary.
All right.
With the police and court and counsel, I'm Bob Winner. I represent Boulder Cap, also DBA. Thank you for taking this writ. It is a very important issue of law. I think it needs clarification. That's why we asked for this. And there are consequences to the decision, be honest. Small businesses we maintain throughout the state that are going to be financially impacted severely, including my client. I'd like to get to the factors under Breitbart of retrospective versus prospective, retroactive. We maintain that the Thomas decision was the new law. Until Thomas, the statute 608250 sub 2 was still the law. It had been on the books for 5 decades.
Counsel, don't you make a distinction as to a constitutional change versus statute? And isn't a constitutional change, in essence, Trump statutory change or difference?
Trump, the word, yes. One of the factors, I think you're right, one of the factors that was unfair was what you were faced with when you made the Thomas decision. You had a statute, plain language, you had amendment, plain language. No consequences. The Constitution had to trump, at least according to Florida. It had to. It gave way. Now, other judges below, other judges sitting here today, disagreed, saying, I can read these in harmony. Now, if that constitutional amendment, the minimum wage amendment, if that was so clear, how come everybody didn't agree? And how come Boulder was supposed to know this happened and change his business practice?
Well, they agree,
been there for decades.
Whether they agree or disagree, if we have a constitutional change, that presumably is, in fact, the law. And it's not being validated, so why would someone think otherwise?
What you're talking about is in 06 when the amendment took effect, it clearly changed the minimum wage. Did he clearly declare 608250 sub 2 unconstitutional? I say it did not. The voting later didn't think so.
Isn't there a specific reference in that subsection that you're talking about that relates to another statutory provision?
Which subsection, I'm sorry?
As you're looking at those two subsections of individual's exemption, doesn't it pertain to a specific section of law?
I see what you're saying. Earlier in the statutory scheme, they talk about minimum wage under this.
Yes.
And your point, I think what you're making is that the Constitution granted this, not that statute. I think that's why we're here, though, isn't it? I mean, what decision, what effect should Thomas have? Should it be prospective or not? Should it be retroactive? Is that where the equities lie? I maintain that until you declared subsection 250 sub 2 unconstitutional, it was law. It was followed by everyone. It had been the law. And that's one of the factors under Breitbart, isn't it? So, did we rely on the statute, existing precedents? Of course we did. It's the way the industry has been compensating cab drivers in this town for decades. Commission.
If that number indicates, that's kind of the lies and part of the problem of us trying to work our way through that. You keep talking about that's a statute, that's a law. Well, the Constitution is a superior law to the statute. The statute has to conform to the Constitution, does it not?
I agree 100%, and if it were unclear, we would need it. Had the legislature, after they met, after the amendment, said, this is now repealed, it's unconstitutional. Had the majority of judges who looked at this, all honorable judges, and declared, that's unconstitutional, you can't do that. It would have been clear. I maintain it wasn't, and that's why we satisfy the factors in Breitbart.
Counsel, I was interested in getting your take on the United States District Court's decision in Thurman versus Presidential Limousine. As you know, that decision is opposite your position. How do you address Judge Dew's position here?
I guess I would say the same thing, the same factor, because I wasn't there. What's going on in the first decision in Thomas, there are consequences to judicial decisions. And if you're only looking at a statute language versus an amendment language, and you've got to reconcile them, as a majority did saying that can't be, that's the decision. There is a rule, a general rule that's in case law is prospective. Judicial decisions are, retroactive. That is the general rule. But we have a rule generally in front of it. There are exceptions, and we fall under that. The blackout factors, had that judge had information like this before you now, maybe the decision would have been different.
So why don't you articulate, if you were doing an opinion that was contrary to Thurman, how would you articulate in the opinion the factors that are before this court that you're not in front of Judge Dew that arrive at a different result?
Well, the factors as well as the evidence is in the appendix in the record below. That's
I'm giving you an opportunity to highlight any points. I mean, you appropriately argue that we're an exception, so let's focus on what are the manner or what are the issues, what are the factors that are in this record that make it so much different than the analysis that the federal court gave to it.
Our Supreme Court, this body before said, one of the factors is substantial and reasonable reliance on previous law, which we have none. The statute was not clearly repealed, was not expressly repealed, it was impliedly repealed through some effort by judicial analysis. Was it foreshadowed? That's another factor of the Bright Hawk. Was it foreshadowed? Should we have seen this coming? I suggest to you, we could not. The Labor Department, so the Commissioner of Labor said, we want an AGO opinion, or AGO on this issue. And they didn't even follow it after they had workshops. I mean, it was out there notified. I didn't see it. We never saw it. But they requested it. We have district judges. We have Supreme Court judges who said, this is a tough issue. How could we have foreseen this? This is clearly foreshadowed. When they took away 5 decades of not payment, they just not guaranteeing it. Most categories make more than
that brings me to a point. First of all, I forgot to mention Justice Sabo is not with us today. She can't be here today. She is actually listening to the webcast. Participate in the deliberations afterwards. So that being said, you just brought up a point that most cab drivers are paid above minimum wage anyway. How do you go back and wind up all this, assuming that were to happen, when you've got commission-based employees who may or may not be above or below minimum wage? Based on commissions.
How do you go back and do it?
How do you figure it out?
It's very difficult, and we've offered all of our records, including the documented records of the hours worked, which I've seen the police say was violating law. That's not true. Trip sheets are maintained, and we have to go back and look at the trip sheet. We've offered those to counsel. They don't want to look at it. They want it on computers so they can run a quick analysis. What you mean, you've got a total revenue from the shift. How much he has made is a part where you reduce the federal chips, and then you can put in the hours, and you can figure that out. You can. We don't have count tips. But it's painstaking to do, and we've offered that to this side, and they just don't want to do it.
Could I ask you to return to another, maybe I didn't articulate the question I wanted to. The third factor under Bright Hawk, applying Chevron, is the inequities. What in this record establishes inequities in this result that were not present in the Thurman federal court case?
Well, I'm not positive what was up there, but I would hazard an educated guess. What wasn't there was the evidence we put in as to our business and how we run it, how we comply with the law, and how much money we generate. We are the smallest cab company restricted, at least at that time, to the southeast part of that. Couldn't pick up on the resort court. We generated the least amount of revenue per shift and per medallion. He was serving that area as he was ordered to be by the state. This is financial consequences to him. He doesn't have that kind of margin. And should you rule retroactivity should apply, the consequences to Boulder Cab, while bigger cab companies might have a bigger dollar figure, the consequences to it is much more severe and dire. I furthermore stated, I mean, just having to pay back pay, okay. Penalties? This is a high turnover job. Guys come in for a week, they don't like it, they leave. Wouldn't there be penalties on this? Attorney fees, punitives? This is inevitable. Especially when you consider the largest cab company, collection of cab companies, the freest companies, they are not subject to this. They don't have to pay punitives or attorney fees. They're exempt from the NWA, the amendment, because they have collective bargaining. The industry, and I've been doing this for a while, the way cab drivers are compensated at Boulder, at Yellow, at Freas, it's all pretty much the same as commission. Unions of the bigger companies negotiate health care, different things over the years, and we have to offer the same thing to compete. But now Freas, who can afford much more than we can, is exempt. That's substantial inequities. I maintain.
Well, one of the issues that Judge Dew mentioned in the federal court analysis on this very issue was the question about reliance on the Lucas decision. You're not arguing that here. Are you saying that Boulder relied on Lucas in 2011?
I can say without question my client did not read the Lucas opinion. He never heard of it. Mm-hmm. I did not read it until we got sued. I heard of it. I've seen mentions in the brief we should have filed some kind of debt relief action. But the judges were all ruling the statute is still there. It's still valid. Cab drivers are exempt. We knew of the Lucas opinion. We knew of it. I don't think I didn't read it. My client didn't read it until after we got sued. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. But
Mr. Ware, can I ask you one other question on retroactivity? It's a very interesting issue. Here we have a constitutional amendment, and as Justice Douglas points out, it might have a different interplay than on statutes. We have a couple of recent Supreme Court decisions on retroactivity on statutory interpretation, and one a number of years ago called Sandpoint, one very recently called Badger. There were split decisions, but the majority in both cases concluded there was no retroactivity with these statutory changes. Do these cases have any interplay with this issue, or are they irrelevant in your point of view in making this determination?
You know, it's always so difficult to confess that I haven't read those, but I haven't.
Well, they're on real estate personal guarantees and foreclosure issues, so they're not on the subject matter we're talking about here, but the principle announced in those cases, I'm just wondering if you have thought about that.
I haven't thought because I haven't read it.
Okay.
I've read our case in the law here at Brighthop, and I say that is good law, and I should follow it.
Very well.
I'm certainly willing to entertain any questions right now, but I'll sit down then. And thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Mr. Greenberg.
May it please the court, I'm Leon Greenberg, and I'm arguing today on behalf of the respondent. To answer some of the questions or address some of the issues raised by the bench on petitioner's argument, Justice Douglas, you are correct in the exemptions that the industry was relying on, which are contained in 608.250 subpart 2, are specifically worded as an exemption to the minimum wage requirements that are set forth in 608.250 subpart 1. The exact language is not declaring an exemption in Nevada from all minimum wage requirements that may in fact be imposed upon employers, but only the ones set forth in the preceding subsection. So for anyone to later take the position that a subsequently enacted law, such as the constitutional amendment, is subject to those exemptions, is essentially turning a blind eye to the actual language of the exemptions themselves, which are limited by their text, Your Honor. Now, in respect to the assertions that have been made here that there was a reliance by the petitioner and its industry on prior precedent. There was no prior precedent from this court. The Constitutional Amendment was enacted in 2006. They didn't have any prior ruling that was stare decisis to rely upon.
But counsel indicated the district courts, in fact, interpreted, how the Constitution statute interplayed finding that the exemptions weren't wiped out by virtue of the amendment to the Constitution. Is that incorrect?
Your Honor, we had a decision from Judge Jones, District Judge Jones in the U.S. District Court in 2009 in the Lucas case. That is not binding precedent. That is the opinion of one jurist in a district court on this issue. If the Lucas plaintiffs had in fact been successful in appealing that decision, and they were not successful in part because Judge Jones denied their request to certify the question to this court, but if they had been successful, we would have had the decision in Thomas, presumably years earlier, and the plaintiffs in Lucas would have benefited from the recognition that this court made in Thomas that Judge Jones' analysis
was. What about the district courts? There were several cases pending in the district courts. Were they inconsistent in the way they were making their determinations on these various cases?
We were a total honor of four decisions that were rendered in 2012 through 2013. One was in the Gilmore versus Desert Cab case, which this court subsequently reversed as an error based upon its decision in Thomas. There was also a decision by Judge Corley in Murray v. ACAP, which agreed with the analysis of this court in Thomas and the analysis of the Attorney General Brian Sandoval in 2005, which put the entire industry on notice as to the analysis that this court ultimately adopted in Thomas. Now, that brings us to this point of foreshadowing. I was explaining that there was no prior precedent that they could rely on. They say, well, it wasn't foreshadowing what this court decided in Thomas, because we couldn't know that the court would arrive at that decision. There were differences of opinion. I mean, we had other judges. We had a portion of this court that took a different view of the application of the Constitution. Well, that claim is turning the meaning of the word foreshadow completely on its head. I mean, the Oxford Online Dictionary defines foreshadow as, quote, a warning or indication of a future event. A foreshadow is not a prophecy. It's not a 100% accurate prediction of what is going to happen. It's a warning that there's a significant chance that something may logically come to pass in the future based upon the information that is available to me in the present. If I get up in the morning and I look out the window and I see that there are dark clouds on the horizon, well, I've been told that there may be a storm later in the day, and maybe I want to take my umbrella before I leave my house. If the storm never comes, well, that's a possibility. But if it does come, I have no one to blame for not bringing my umbrella but myself. So to the extent that the industry here is claiming that they were justified in their failure to follow the Attorney General's opinion, or the opinion of the New York Medicine Fund, which is counsel for some cab amicus in these proceedings, who also issued a public advisement to Bermudan employers in 2006, that numerous employers, including taxi drivers, would be covered by the constitutional amendment. The Little Law Firm is the largest employer-side labor law firm in the entire United States, so one would think that their advice had some sound basis. Now, it is true that this court does not always agree with the opinions of the Attorney General. But as I was explaining, to foreshadow is not to predict with certainty. It is a question of being informed as to a reasonable possibility.
Just going to that point, understanding how this court struggled with the issue and the division in the court on that very issue, if we couldn't come to a 7-0 determination on it, how does that affect your foreshadowing argument?
The issue is, as we all understand and learn at a very young age, that ignorance of the law is not an excuse. In Barlow v. the United States in 1833, Judge Story stated, and I quote, "It is a common maxim familiar to all minds that ignorance of the law will not excuse any person either civilly or criminally." Now, Judge Story went on to explain that the reason for the rule is to put individuals on a basis that they need to inquire, that they can't simply be blind to the clouds that are gathering on the horizon and the possibility that the storm may be coming later in
today. And to quote Judge Story again, quote, there is scarcely any law which does not admit of some ingenious doubt. And there would be perpetual temptations to violations of the laws if men were not put upon extreme vigilance to avoid them. This rule of law is inherent in our system of justice. It's existing, we'll be going back to not just Judge Story, but, you know, Blackstone, the Magna Carta itself, which we're now celebrating in the 800th anniversary of, that individuals are charged with a duty to ascertain the law. Now, if the law is completely unascertainable here, perhaps the petition would warrant a different view and a different means of examination. But clearly the law is not unascertainable. This is not a situation where the industry and the petitioner had absolutely no inkling that this could come to pass. Clearly they knew that it could. They made a conscious decision to not inquire, to not confirm their conduct to what was ultimately decided by this court in Thomas, or not to affirmatively ask the courts of the state of Nevada to make a ruling and determine this issue. Now, counsel for Boulder Cab was just noting that the Frias Companies, which is the largest operator in the industry here in Las Vegas, is exempt from the law because they have a collective bargaining agreement. They're not exempt by virtue of having a collective bargaining agreement. They're exempt because they negotiated specifically with their driver's union and achieved that at the bargaining table, and that is a function also of the supremacy of federal labor law. Now, that happened in 2008. So clearly the industry was on notice and knew that this was an issue. Petitioner Yellow and Checker Star similarly attempted to negotiate such a waiver with its union starting in 2008. This is documented in the record. They were unsuccessful in doing so. And subsequently in 2013, there was a 60-day strike at Yellow Checker Star in connection with the contract negotiations, and they still didn't secure that waiver. So this idea that the law was not reasonably ascertainable to the industry here, or to the petitioners, has no basis in reality. They made the decision that they would simply force their drivers to sue them if their drivers wish to exercise their rights under the Constitution to these minimum wages.
Mr. Greenberg, yes. Can you respond to an issue I have? In this case, the appellants argue that the petitioners argue that the court should apply the tests in Brayford to avoid the retroactivity consequences of the Thomas decision. Is the Brayhop case even applicable here? In that case, this court was dealing with competing interpretations of an insurance statute. Here, we're dealing with whether or not the provisions of an existing statute were repealed by the constitutional amendment. As well, there's been considerable criticism of the Chevron case under which the Brayhop decision was entered. Would you comment on those issues?
Yes, Your Honor. The criticism of the Chevron decision would actually narrow or make less available the potential for prospective relief as this court was discussing in the Brayhop decision. Now, Brayhop was not actually dealing with a newly enacted statute and a question of a defense to a newly enacted statute and the overruling of that defense, which is the precise situation we have here. In this case, if one was reading the constitutional amendment in isolation, there is no question that the taxi industry is covered by the amendment. I mean, the language is absolute. It states every employee shall be paid a minimum wage by their employer, except as specified herein. There's no specification taking taxi drivers out of that coverage. What the industry did is they came in and said, well, look, yes, that's the language that's here, but if we look at the prior statutory scheme, if we look at the fact that this language doesn't mention the prior statutory scheme, it creates a question of an ambiguity by essentially silence, or a question of that, well, should we really be looking at what the voters intended, what was the purpose and intent behind the constitutional amendment when it was enacted? This court ultimately rejected that analytic approach to the
the scope of the statute and said, no, we must apply it as enacted because that is the nature of our law. Now, they were free to make that argument, and they did make that argument. They raised that defense. They forced their drivers to go ahead and sue them and overcome that defense. Well, they lost their gamble. They lost their bet. They don't now get to come and tell the court, well, you know, give us absolution, and we'll go and sin no more, and that'll be enough. I mean, that's not the nature of our system. But to specifically answer your question about Breithaupt further, Your Honor, in Breithaupt, there was prior judicial precedent that this court was considering whether to retroactively overrule. It declined to do so. There was also a statute that changed the law because the legislature decided they didn't like that decision by this court. Now, here, we don't even have a prior precedent from this court. There was no prior decision from this court that the industry could rely on because the court had never ruled upon their defense to the Constitutional Amendment.
So assuming the court said, well, yes, whether under Breithaupt or under general rules that the Thomas case applies retroactively. In this instance, counsel has argued that it would be inequitable to apply it retroactively, a third element in Breithaupt. What is it about this record that makes the enforcement of this decision inequitable to the petitioners? Is there something unique in this record that would cause this court to say we're going to disregard these general principles?
There is nothing in this record supporting these claims of inequity. All we have are assertions from the petitioners that this would harm their business, it would harm their financial interests. Counsel for the petitioners just stated that they are a small business. This would be very difficult for them. We have nothing in the record asserting this. I mean, for all we know, if they had followed the law in 2006, or if Thomas had been issued in 2006, they would have operated in the exact same fashion and still made a handsome profit in their business, perhaps a little bit of a less of a profit because they would have had to pay slightly less.
Is there anything in this record that suggests that this company operated different after the Lucas decision in 2011, which seemed to contradict the Thomas holding?
This company essentially adopted the same ostrich head in the sand position to the law as the entire industry, except for the freeze company, which actually negotiated a waiver, and Kenyella Checker Star, which attempted to negotiate a waiver. They essentially ignored the law and waited to be sued. And now they're here complaining that they're going to have to pay the price of the decision they made. But they had options. They could have gone to the legislature, asked for financial relief for the industry to pay these wages. They could still do that, actually. They could have gone to the people of the state of Nevada and attempted to have the Constitution further amended to address these perceived inequities. There is nothing in the record supporting their claims that this decision would be inequitable or would render an improper hardship upon them or their industry. My time is up.
It is, and let me ask my colleagues, do you have any other questions you'd like to ask?
None?
Thank you, Mr. Pritz.
Thank you.
While ignorance of the law is no excuse, we are entitled to know what the law is, aren't we? And if the law is going to change, shouldn't that be done clearly and announced?
But you have a constitutional amendment that textually is adverse to your position, and Thomas read that constitutional amendment adversely to you. But I don't see this as a Breithaupt position, because when we construe a constitutional provision, we are saying what that constitutional provision says at the time it was enacted and thence forward. So I'm having trouble putting the Breithaupt shoe on this foot, if you will.
Well, I don't know if I can help with that sizing.
You might be able to.
As I recall reading the law, when you interpret an implied repeal, this is kind of general principles, you do the same thing with statutes as constitutional amendments. It's the same standard, the repugnancy standard. And I know four of you used that language, said they are irreparably repugnant, and I get that. If the law or the standard had been in conflict, you wouldn't use that language. I suggest to you that we rely on the rule of law. And Breithoff, even though it's talking about statutes, isn't that the same standard? No. But isn't an implied repeal for statutes the same as amendments? I think that's the law. I didn't cite it, but that's the law, I believe. You use the same standard, repugnancy. So I didn't really tell it to know what the law is, and if it changed, you know, I think it clearly did under Thomas. I respect what you're saying. I understand it. And you say, if something in 06 repealed it, it happened then. But we didn't see it. Most judges didn't see it until you ruled. And that's why we find the inequities here so compelling.
So you take them. Your position is Breithoff applies even though it's an imperfect fit.
I don't think it's imperfect. I think the second standard, for example, which I don't think applies here, that would have been the instance. There was a case, I think it was Anderson out of California, where default judgments, somebody challenged them and said due process violation. Well, the Constitution had been around for a couple of centuries. And they looked at that and said, ooh, he's right. He's right. There's a due process violation. Well, we're not going to go redo all of these things here. No. We're going to make this prospective. Just like Miranda, when they said you've got to tell the defendant, you know, he's entitled to certain rights, they didn't retry these cases. There are factors involved in equities. Now, that one doesn't apply here, that middle one, to Breithoff. But I say Breithoff applies, and I hope you do. And now I think I should sit down. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Yeah, before you sit down, colleagues, anything? All right, thank you both for your presentations. The briefing was very good in this case. We appreciate your time, and let's go ahead and reconstitute for the next case.